Greetings from the voice of Allan Kardec.
And welcome from the voice of the spirits.
We are here once again to take you on another small journey through The Spirits book by Allan Kardec. Today we will continue with the introduction, covering sections 9, 10, and 11.
Enjoy.
Section 9. The movement of inert objects is a proven fact. However, it remains to be seen whether or not there are manifestations of intelligence in such movement, and if so, what their source is. We are not referring to manifestations involving the intelligent movement of certain objects, to manifestations involving verbal communications, or to communications written directly by the medium's hand. These kinds of manifestations are quite obvious to those who have deeply investigated the subject, but they may not at first glance be sufficiently independent of the medium's own will to be convincing to a new observer. Thus, we will focus only on the writings obtained with the help of a pencil attached to some object such as a small basket, a planchette, etc. As we have stated, the way in which the medium's fingers are placed upon the object challenges the notion that any sort of skillful interference is at work in the way the words are formed. For the sake of discussion, however, let us suppose that by some extraordinary ability, the medium might be able to deceive the most attentive observer. How could one explain the nature of the responses themselves when they are beyond the scope of the medium's own ideas and knowledge? We are not referring here to simple one-syllable replies, but to many pages written with the astounding speed on a subject that may either be spontaneous or specifically requested. From the hand of a medium completely unversed in literature stream forth poems of such sublimity and impeccable purity that they are worthy of the best human poets. In addition, what is even more remarkable is the fact that these pages are being produced everywhere and the number of mediums is rapidly increasing. Are these occurrences real or not? To this question, we can only reply, watch and observe. The opportunities will not be lacking. Above all, however, observe persistently over a long period of time and under the appropriate conditions. How have our antagonists responded to the evidence? They say, you are victims of either charlatanism or illusion. First, we will reply that charlatanism is not likely where there is no profit to be made. Charlatans do not work for free. It would be a prank at the most. But by what strange coincidence would pranksters have an understanding amongst themselves from one end of the world to the other, leading them to act in the same way to produce the same effects and to give identical answers on the same subjects in their various languages, if not in the exact same words, at least implying the same meaning? Why would serious, respectable, and educated persons cater to such maneuvers, and for what purpose? Why has the patience and skill required for producing these phenomena been found even among children? After all, unless mediums are mere passive instruments, it is obvious that we would have to confer on them capabilities and knowledge far beyond their age and social position. Next, our opponents state that if no fraud is involved, then both parties, mediums and observers, might be deceived by an illusion. There is no question that the quality of the witness does carry a certain weight. It is therefore reasonable to ask whether the Spiritist doctrine, which today has millions of followers, only recruits from among the uneducated. The phenomena on which Spiritism is based seem so extraordinary that we can understand such depth, but we cannot accept the claim of certain skeptics that they hold a monopoly on common sense. Those who, without respect for the conventions and moral values of their adversaries, label as incompetent all those who do not agree with their opinions. For judicious persons, the opinions of educated individuals who have observed, studied, and thought about a matter at length will always be, if not actual proof, then a likely hypothesis at the very least. After all, Spiritism has grabbed the attention of serious individuals who have neither an interest in propagating an error nor time to waste on futilities. Section 10. Among our opponents' objections, there are some that are more plausible, at least in appearance, because they are based on observation and are raised by serious individuals. One such observation refers to the language of certain spirits, which does not seem worthy of the loftiness that might be attributed to supernatural beings. However, if we refer to the summary of the doctrine presented above, we will see that spirits themselves teach us that they are not all equal to one another in knowledge or moral qualities, and that we must not take everything that spirits tell us at face value. It falls to sensible persons to separate the good from the bad. Obviously, those who conclude from this fact that we deal solely with evil beings whose sole intention is to deceive are unfamiliar with the communications given during meetings in which high-order spirits manifest. If they were, they would think otherwise. It is unfortunate that chance has served these persons so badly by showing them only the decadent side of the spirit world. On the other hand, we do not want to presume that an affinity of inclinations might have attracted evil, deceitful, and foul-mouthed spirits to them rather than good ones. We could conclude, at most, that the strength of their principles is not solid enough to preserve them from evil, and since they find a certain pleasure in satisfying their own curiosity, evil spirits take advantage of this fact to mingle with them, whereas good spirits stay away. Judging the character of spirits by such facts would be as illogical as judging the character of an entire people by what is said and done in a group of a few wild or disreputable individuals who do not deserve the company of either learned or sensible persons. Those who judge in this way are like foreigners who enter a great capital by way of the worst outskirts and then proceed to judge the entire population of the city according to the customs and speech of this one neighborhood. In the spirit world, there is also a good and an evil society. If such individuals would actually study what happens among high-ordered spirits, they would realize that the celestial city does not contain only the dregs of society. Nonetheless, they might ask, do high-order spirits really come to us? And we would reply, do not remain on the outskirts. Watch, observe, and judge for yourselves. The facts are here for everybody to see, except those to whom the words of Jesus apply. They have eyes, but do not see. They have ears, but do not hear. A different variation of this opinion considers all spirit communications and all physical manifestations as being nothing more than the intervention of some diabolical power, a new Proteus, who can assume any form it wants in order to better deceive us. We do not consider such an idea to be worthy of serious examination, and thus will not dwell on it here. It has already been refuted by what we stated earlier. We would only add that if such were the case, we would have to concede that the devil is sometimes very wise, very reasonable, and especially very moral, or that there are good devils. In fact, how could we believe that God would allow only the spirit of evil to manifest himself in order to deceive us without providing us the counsels of good spirits as a counterweight? If God could not do so, it would imply powerlessness. If God could but did not, it would be incompatible with divine goodness. Either supposition would, of course, be blasphemous. However, we would like to emphasize that accepting the fact that evil spirits do really communicate means accepting the fact that spirit manifestations do really occur. And since they do occur, it is only with divine permission. Without being impious, how can we believe that God would permit only evil manifestations to the exclusion of good ones? Such a doctrine is contrary both to the simplest notions of common sense and religion. Section 11. Other opponents add that it is strange that we seem to concern ourselves only with the spirits of well-known individuals, and they ask why these are the only ones who manifest. Like many other errors, this one comes from superficial observation. Among the spirits who manifest spontaneously, those who are unknown outnumber the illustrious ones. They often take names that are allegorical or in keeping with their character. As for those whom we evoke, except in the cases of relatives or friends, it is quite natural that we would prefer those we know rather than those we do not know. As for illustrious personalities, they are the ones who are noticed more, and so they attract more attention. These opponents also consider it strange that the spirits of eminent individuals casually respond to our appeal, and that they sometimes concern themselves with matters that seem insignificant when compared to what they accomplish during their lives. However, this is not so surprising to those who know that the power and respect that such individuals enjoyed on earth do not necessarily entitle them to any supremacy in the spirit world. The spirits confirm the gospel words, "The great shall be abased, and the small shall be exalted." which must be understood as relating to the position each of us will occupy among them. Thus, those who had been first on the earth may find themselves among the last in the spirit world. Those who make us bow to them in this life may return as the most humble laborers. For when they leave the earthly life behind, they leave all their grandeur behind as well. The most powerful monarchs might find themselves to be below their lowest ranking soldiers.